The topic that for today's session is the changing workplace, and I've said it's also a changing worker, and it's also changing work. And I will talk a little bit about the place that I work, so just to give you some context, I work for a firm that manages large direct mail fundraising programs that contributes all the junk mail to your mailboxes. It's very similar to working in an advertising agency with about 40 people on the West Coast where I work and another 100 or so on the East Coast. And in addition to that responsibility, which is described in here, if anyone's interested in that newsletter, is another newsletter of an organization that I've been associated with for about 9 years, namely New Models for Ministry, which seeks to discover and celebrate all of our ministry in everyday life, on the assumption that even clergy have to deal with some daily life issues, as well as the rest of us who deal with those issues every day. I'll pass around some copies of that newsletter if you haven't received one. If you'd like to continue to receive new ministries at no obligation, please feel free to put your name and address on the list. In approximately the 45 minutes that we have together, I'd like to talk with you about three questions or three areas. One is to talk about your experience of the changing workplace. How has work changed for you? And to see that as part of a larger landscape of change in our society. The second question is to address what resources our Christian faith, if any, have for dealing with or responding to that change. And then thirdly, to see whether or not the change in the nature of work provides some unique opportunities for the church, to which most of us will return, opportunities for the church to be in ministry in a new way. So I'll do that. In the bookstore, there are some books. One of them that is a little bit older, but it's still very powerful. It's called Modern Work and Human Meaning. And there's a table with books on there. There's also a book that I did not bring along that I think is very helpful on the second question, namely the resources of our Christian faith, called In Search of Faithfulness by Bill Deal. And that book is talked about on the back page of the newsletter. How has work changed? Let's talk together. What's different about your work, or how has work changed in your own lifetime?
Automation.
Okay. What else has changed about work for you?
New discoveries, new technology.
Okay, new discoveries. New technology.
New philosophy.
In what way?
I work in the field with people who are developmentally disabled, so that's been a real fast-growing field in the 15 years I've been there. More mainstreaming and moving people into the regular population, deinstitutionalization is described.
Deinstitutionalization, it's not...
There's more to it than that, but that's a
catch-all. Yes.
Rationalization of evaluation. Because of the academy, that used to be done on a sort of intuitive level.
Yes.
And now it's becoming increasingly rationalized. Here are the criteria, here are the things you're evaluated on.
Right. The firm I work with, you have a job description, you have quarterly performance reviews, which attempt to be objective in some way. You know, it's not, gee, he's a really good guy, or he's got a nice family, and he dresses well. Those things aren't part of most evaluations anymore. Other ways that work has changed, or hasn't it?
When you have new discoveries, I'm thinking of the upward movement of life expectancy. Medical progress has given us many more senior citizens.
Okay.
Work has changed because there is a whole category of people who are not working anymore, which is very different,
or as we talked about.
Or working longer. Yeah.
Since I've been doing this very long, I can't perceive it, but I know that in my field there's been a loss of the buying power of monetary compensation.
Yes. Been one of my themes for this last few weeks.
And the other thing would be changing
clientele. Just to say, yeah. What? Say more about that.
The difference for me between what 25 years ago the college students, or 50 years ago, often first generation college students.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of kids who are in college because they couldn't think of anything else to do.
Right.
It changes how I work compared to what it would be somewhere else.
There's a couple of changes behind that. Let me just, before I forget this one, is we've been talking about since 1973, compensation has declined somewhere between 15 and 23% in real dollars, so that people are earning less money. The changing clientele means that people are going to college for two reasons: because there's nothing else to do, but also because the college degree is now the entrance requirement for most significant jobs in our society. The gap between a college degree and non-college degree is pretty startling. Well, I won't worry about that. It's about $10,000. And that gap is growing. Yes.
Second careers.
Yes. At least second careers.
My work has changed in that there are more two-income families and less people to volunteer.
More commuting.
Right. So just to be clear about that, 73% of women who are between 25 and 45 work.
I think when you put women into the workforce, too, you also have things changing in that the business atmosphere is different. Mm-hmm. That female characteristics are more accepted in the workplace.
Yes. I'm sorry, you said something and I didn't get it.
No,
I'm
commuting.
Commuting.
People go farther to go to work.
Seems like there's a wider gap in pay even between so-called professionals.
Yes.
Was your idea last year something about less volunteer?
Okay.
Because of the two income families.
Two things have happened because there are fewer volunteers.
Because the two-income family, there's less volunteers.
But there have been two other changes in the workforce because there are fewer volunteers. What do we do? How do we replace the volunteers? Okay, so we have people who are paid to do that.
And things don't get done.
Yeah.
People
burn out trying to do something.
The third thing is the tremendous growth of what Peter, there's one other book that I didn't put, Peter Drucker, The Changing World of the Executive. And Peter Drucker just sort of says the same thing over and over again, but but he can do that because he says it so well. But the growth of the third sector both because there are fewer volunteers and because we have to pay those volunteers, what was done voluntarily and informally is now an organized sector. The third sector now employs more people.
That's the service sector, is that what you're talking about?
No, the third sector are non-profit, so-called voluntary organizations. Now employ more people than the first sector, which is the economy, the business world, and the second sector, which is the government. So more people are employed in this third sector than the other. That's hospitals, that's colleges, that's Red Cross, etc.
My experience of being a volunteer in that kind of organization, in a young organization, is that there's a sort of change toward professionalization, so that a group that starts out volunteer shifts, and the commitments of the people who are part of it as employees and the sort of second generation of employees are a little different.
Yes.
Those who were in the first.
Right. Lots of nonprofit organizations face this transition from a voluntary board of directors that do everything to make it happen, and then you hire your first staff person, and we can see it as we work with nonprofits. You see it in the shape of a budget. And then once that starts, for most organizations, there's incredible conflict because the values and goals are different. But once it's made through that transition, there's usually no turning back. It's both good. Other things that have changed about work?
Child care.
Okay. Yes.
Back to the volunteerism just for a minute, too. There is a tendency to misuse volunteers and not keep in mind that they too are the people. Their only pay is getting benefit
right.
from their job. And
yes.
I think workplaces like big companies are saying, oh, wouldn't you like to stay in touch? And then they're using those volunteers to do jobs that they should be paying for instead
yes.
of, and they're making a profit off of their work.
Yes. As well as getting lots of good publicity. Yes?
Participative management.
Okay. Big word, but that's very important. We talked last night. For me, the metaphor has become what Diane said about her work here at Holden. No one comes and checks up on me. But yet Diane is obligated to participate in management decisions about Holden Village. She thought that was unique to Holden. It isn't.
I think you'll find a lot of, at least I see a lot of handicap working in places I never expected them to 50 years ago.
Okay. Involvement of non-traditional workers. I don't know, it's not just handicapped persons, but the whole realm of people that work.
I see the larger corporations versus small environment, like the small farms or the small grocery stores just don't exist in the, so you, ramifications are fairly significant, I think.
Yes.
More structure in typical cases, less entrepreneurialism.
Right. We actually have a paradox or a contrary going on in our society.
Right.
We have these creations of these mega companies as supermarkets become parts of chain, as Banana Republic is bought out by Limited or Gap? By Gap, I believe. So you have this incredible aggregation into large corporations. At the same time, you have the proliferation of very small businesses as well as people who are self-employed. The number of self-employed persons is quite significant. In the Baby Boomer book that we've talked about, it's predicted that half of all baby boomers at one point in their life will be self-employed freelancers for a period of time.
Yeah. More litigation.
Yes. As my business mentor in LA says, every decision I make is a two phone call decision. I call my accountant and I call my lawyer.
So along with litigation will go regulation.
Mm-hmm. We'll certainly see more regulation despite the effort. I mean, in a sense, the paradox of the Reagan administration is that it has now ushered in a new era of more intense regulation than ever before.
And because of that, we are finding the insurance costs and so forth determining what our programs of social nonprofit organizations are instead of the need of the people. We've had, like PYC in Minneapolis has had to discontinue its kinswoman program, not because there weren't kids crying for it and big brothers and big sisters wanting to do it, but because they couldn't afford the insurance. Mm. And that is happening all over. The organization says we can't afford to continue it. And then you, this thing down in Texas where the Justice for Sale article in Reader's Digest a while ago, where the insurance company and the lawyers kind of bought out the political people and determined what was going to be on the agenda.
That is often, that is frequently happening. The larger phenomenon that Drucker talks about, not in this book and in other books though, is that every organization is now has multiple constituencies. St. Olaf's no longer has just students as its constituency. It has alumni as constituency. It has donors as constituency. It has corporations as constituency. It has the federal government as a constituency, and it has the insurance business. So that every institution has to be multifaceted in order to relate to those constituencies. Any other? Let me just, if I can find an eraser, just, here it is. Is there a way to give any shape to this, or if we've missed anything? Let me just. There it goes. Let me try to organize it. Isn't this the tragedy of whiteboards? Maybe I should have left it. Nah. Let me see if I can and reorganize some of this. Just to be cute, I've come up with three C's: competence, computer, collaboration. What has happened in the workplace is the incredible increase in what one would call a specialist, expert, and what Drucker calls a knowledge worker, someone who knows a lot about some area of expertise, and that she or he is responsible for that area of expertise. And in an educational institution is a good example of that. One is judged not by the health department of a college. One is judged not even by the president of a college, but by one's peers who are experts. The standards of teaching, the standards of scholarship are judged by a very narrow area of expertise. We can see that in our business. There are people who make their livings knowing how to write, not just write, but write a certain kind of letter. There are people that make two or three times what you and I make just because they know a lot about one very small area of expertise. And it requires a great deal of competence. Some of the implications are that, as Deanne suggested, is people are going to college to gain that level of competence. That becomes the training ground for that. The next C is the computer. We suggested automation. There's a book that I did not bring along because it is so big and so expensive. If it ever comes out in paperback and you really need some good, you have problems with insomnia, this is a remarkable book. It is very, very provocative. in the age of the smart machine. Shoshana Zuboff is a professor at the Harvard Business School. What she is talking about is the transformation from an industrial economy to a computer-mediated economy. And she does some case studies. And that her basic thesis is that we no longer perceive reality directly. Through the computer, everything is now mediated by the computer screen. And she talks about a pulp mill and how the workers who had worked there for 20 or 30 years used to go around and they would actually taste the pulp to see if it were ready to make paper. Or they would kick the pump to see if the pump were in shape and it was going to keep working. Or they would listen for the sounds of the mill as it went through. And they could tell intuitively, she calls it sensate, they would sense it through their bodies unconsciously when things were going all right. Now they sit in a room and all of their information about how the mill is working is mediated through the computer. How many of you work with computers? How many of you worked with computers 5 years ago? When we hire someone, we don't even ask, should we get them a computer? We ask, how soon can we get the computer delivered to be there for the when the employee comes? It is assumed if you come to work, no matter what level in our company, whether you're you enter at the lowest paid salary or at the highest paid salary, it's assumed that you're going to have a computer, that that's the way in which our business is mediated. Well, one thing is the issue of collaboration. Someone talked about participative management. There's decentralization. All of the trends in modern corporate life or modern institutional life to decentralize, to tear down the hierarchy. Just think about, I'm trying to think of what, maybe when I was still working, how did one refer to bosses? They were Mr. Smith. I don't know many work environments in which bosses are still referred to by their title. Very, very few. Even in the classroom, one sees the tendency no longer to call professors by professor or doctor. That's symbolic of, I think, that. What happens, really this need to collaborate is the result of these two. Because you have this collection of people who are experts, nobody has more knowledge than anyone else, or at least they have knowledge about a separate area. The only way that knowledge can be used is if people collaborate and do it in a democratic process. What the computer has done is make information immediately accessible to everyone. One of the functions of management was to hoard information. The bosses were bosses because they knew more. They had more of the information. The owner of our company is paranoid about everyone knowing the financial information about our company. And so we don't distribute financial statements to workers. I happen to disagree with that in part for ethical reasons, but there's a very practical reason why I think it's also stupid. Anybody who has access to a computer and a little bit of knowledge can put together the financial statements for our company. The computer has all of that in it in some way or another. And so when everyone has the same information, again, the only way to work is through collaboration. Any questions, or does this sound stupid? Does it ring bells?
No, I think one of the best examples of this thing about the computer is listening to men my father's age talk about cars.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real frustration. You know, they say, oh, I used to know how to fix my car. And now I can't because it's got all these chips in it.
Yes.
And I don't know how to make it, I don't know how to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. You used to be able to open the hood and see the ground. you absolutely cannot see anything but gadgets.
Yeah.
It's too complicated to fix.
Cars are not repaired. The components are replaced. The computer chips are, you go and you put the new computer chip in. Yes?
With that lack of ability to control and be in charge, there's also a greater danger of infiltration or stealing of your programs and ideas that's happening, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. The result of all of this is in many ways positive. It enables people to develop areas of which they have greater degree of autonomy. I mean, that makes people feel good. This sense of democratic, the democracy of the workplace where everyone participates at the same level, this access to information so that we don't feel like victims. However, we also feel very vulnerable because the fourth C, obviously, is change. Not only does someone steal the program, but if information is now the basic component of the workplace, then anybody can put that information together. The decline in industrial jobs in 1 year, 1986, almost 250,000 industrial jobs were lost. More people now work for McDonald's than work for U.S. Steel.
And those jobs have gone to other countries?
Many of those jobs have gone to other countries, or as in the pulp mill, where you used to have a whole shift of people. You have one or two people that sit in a control room that replace hundreds of people that would produce pulp. And again, they're not dealing in producing a product. Their job is to control the knowledge or the information that exists.
It seems to me one of the other vulnerabilities that comes from this is that competence is often abstracted from the person.
Yes.
So that people feel very vulnerable because there's no attention to the person. There's just attention to, can you do this job?
Right.
And of course, that has been the case for a long time in certain sectors of, mm-hmm. of work. But it seems to me to infiltrate into areas where it wasn't before.
Right.
Getting more impersonal type?
Yeah.
One of the case studies that Shoshana Zuboff talks about is the change in a claims process. It used to be insurance claims, they would have these processing managers, women in most cases, who became very knowledgeable about the rules and about the categories that claims would be made. And they would make decisions about those claims based upon their understanding of the rules. It was a very time-consuming, tedious process. Now, it doesn't matter who processes the claim. All you have to know is the computer routine. And you feed the information to the computer, and the computer makes the decision now whether to award the claim or not. And the computer instantly, once it's made the decision, the computer writes out the check. And so if you've made a mistake, there's no retrieving because it's already happened. The other point they made is that they used to often call people to verify the claims. They don't even call people, so there's no human contact anymore.
With that impersonal thing also comes a lack of loyalty to and a lack of faithfulness to any one corporation, doesn't it? There used to be such, this is my company.
Right.
And they felt ownership and even reaped the benefits of it. And
right.
What can we do about this thing?
Yeah, I mean, if your job is sitting in an office,
processing information through a computer, you can do that any place with any company. The jobs become very similar, which is, I think, one of the reasons there's a decline. Yes?
I wonder what this does to us as a society as a whole, because I can think when the last time I called my insurance company and I talked to someone on a personal basis about something,
uh-huh.
and we ended up even talking about the weather. It was so, yeah. I mean, it changed my whole day.
Yes.
As opposed to when you try to get through a call and you're on call waiting, or you're waiting uh-huh. for hours and then you have a punch, something punched in. Well, what does that do to us as a people?
Well, I think even that even points up places like Land's End. I don't know if anybody's ever ordered anything from Land's End.
Yeah.
You call and you get the nicest person on the phone, and they'll ask you how it is in Reno,
yeah.
and they'll tell you about the weather there, and you feel so good that all you want to do is support them. And what I'm wondering is if we're not going to see a turnaround back in, because people are just hungering
for that kind of thing.
Well, I think
that's really true. We live in the Seattle area in Nordstrom's. I don't
yes.
know how many of
yes.
you are familiar
oh, yes.
with that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that makes Nordstrom's distinctive and that other, you know, large stores of that
mm-hmm.
type are picking up is the personal touch. The customer is always right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the customer service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Nordstrom's expands. That's what it takes into the community.
It is the paradox in the workplace where you have what's called high touch and high tech at the same time. And as technology becomes higher and more refined, the need for touch, the need for interpersonal interaction increases a great deal. I think that that's one of the reasons why work hours are declining. Most of us think we're working harder and harder. The statistics seem to point the opposite, that we're actually working fewer hours each day. I think it's because that it's become so technological, so impersonal, that we cannot sustain that as human beings over a long period of time. Well, Ruth, question: what can we do about this? What I'd like to say is, what can we as Christians do? Do we have any resources in the treasure in earthen vessels, if you will, to understand our own work in a new way, and to help others who are also in the workplace? I just quickly identified three things that I thought my own Christian faith, that in an area where this is valued so highly, it seems to me that the message of the gospel, that self-worth and satisfaction come not from what you do, but who you are, what your calling and baptism is, to me is a reassuring thing. One of the traps, and this book talks about, this is basically a chronicle of the decline of industrial America, where blue-collar workers have lost their jobs and therefore lost their human meaning. And one of the great tragedies of work in America is that work has become the way in which most of us have status and prestige in society. After you ask someone where they live, the second thing you ask them is, what do you do for a living, or what's your job?
But
well,
isn't
yeah.
that class related?
That's the contention here, yes.
Because my father comes from a family where none of his brothers went to college. They all worked at Collins Radio
right.
on the line, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't ask people that,
what do you do?
Because that's what you do, but it's not what you care about. It's not what you talk about. So
right.
people, you know, like in professionals say, what do you do? Like, that's going to tell me something about you. But
right.
someone who works on an assembly line, in my experience, they don't ask you that question. And if you ask them, they are sort of like, why did you ask?
Right. The point that's made in this book is that for blue-collar workers, which are disappearing rapidly, change is the threat, because what you do is not very important, but that things stay the same, that you have a job. Yes. There. It doesn't matter what you do. It matters that you have a job or don't have a job. Employment is therefore one's, you know, you're making a living, you're providing for your family.
And therefore, when that security is destroyed, as it is rapidly being eroded in industrial society, then that is threatening. But the reality of, for the major force workforce, most of us are going to be professionals. Most of us are going to be knowledge workers. The tragedy is, though, that that work is becoming homogenized. We're all doing the same thing. And that work is changing so dramatically that to somehow derive our status or worth for that becomes more and more of a challenge. And since our compensation is declining, the other form in which status is arrived at is namely through a high salary. You know, I make $70,000 as a corporate attorney. Well, there are going to be fewer and fewer people making money as corporate attorneys because the computers are going to be able to do corporate law. So I submit that the message of the is that our self-worth and our satisfaction derive from another source. And certainly I see that in the people that I work with. Those people who are able to play well with other children and get their work done are those people that come to Mal Warwick and Associates with some sense of identity and self-esteem already in place. You cannot earn self-esteem at Mal Warwick and Associates. It just doesn't work. Secondly, I think that with the issue of collaboration, the issue of building community, is one of the critical issues of the modern workplace. I think as Christians, we have lots of practice in that. We don't always do it well, but at least we have some of the rhetoric, we have some of the attempts to do that, we have some of the lightning, you know, the image that's often used, that if you ever walk through a room in a thunderstorm and it's dark, suddenly the lightning strikes, and then you see the whole room and you know where you are. Well, I think we have some lightning strikes of what community can be like, whether it's here at Holden, whether it's in our congregation.
Brief.
Most especially, I think, what we have, albeit again flawed and inadequate, are some models to involve diversity and democracy. What's clear about the modern workforce is how diverse it is, both ethnically and culturally. At least in church, we have examples of lots of different generations, lots of different people. Deanne talked about the effort to do things by consensus. And I think that happens more often in Christian community than in other places. I've learned in my workforce that if you don't have consensus, the decision will very rarely get implemented. Finally, the issue that we talked about briefly, which I think is one of the major changes in the workplace, is that the influx of women. Two-thirds of all growth in jobs are because women have entered the workplace. I think that, again, we haven't done it very well, but I think we have a head start on the rest of society about talking, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, not to somehow blend them into oblivion, but there are two genders, if you will, and that we will work together. What does it mean to have equality? What does it mean to have equal participation? And I think that that we have some resources in our Christian faith for that. Any comments or questions about that? Any other parts of your own faith that you struggle with change in the workplace?
So you're seeing self-worth and satisfaction are going to help you endure at work in a hard work situation. Is that what you're saying? On pay up there?
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, that says it straightforwardly. that somehow my work is not identified by what I do in the workplace, that it transcends that. And certainly, since I am not going to ever make lots of money, most of us never will, satisfaction or compensation comes from someplace else.
Can we go another step on that? If we have self-worth and satisfaction that comes out of our baptismal covenant and our membership in the community of faith, not only does that help us endure in a difficult situation, it helps us help a difficult situation.
Yeah, I'm not of the persuasion that work is a grim and drear place, because I think that there are positive forces in the workplace. But my point of view is that only if you come with some transcendent self-worth are you going to see some of those opportunities for positive change. Otherwise, we have the whiners, you know, that sit around and say how bad everything is and how oppressive this workplace is.
Monetary compensation.
Right. What people want to do is have others to work with and to have that sense of being part of a team, but also have a sense that their own craft is respected, that their own area of expertise.
Well, I just wanted to raise a question. You know, I've been spending most of my life in the arts, and I perceive what's really happening there. But there's a small group of superstars, whether it be in music or art, and that whole large area of artists that you used to see in the community, they're gone. It seems to me, but I'd be interested in your reaction. You're either very good or you don't exist.
I guess I experience the growth in arts at the community level. While we do have, again, we have this paradox of the superstars, the people that are somehow overpaid, there's been this also the democratization, the tremendous growth in repertory theaters, the tremendous growth in small art museums and galleries.
But where are those geographically? Regional cities.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Regional centers.
Right.
They're not in small towns.
You know, I look at that a little differently, though, and I look at what I see over in the Village Center as art coming out. It may not be as refined and perfect as you see in a major metropolitan setting, but on the other hand, it just boggles my mind to see the art that comes out of the group here.
But how many are making a living?
Well, I'm not even making a living.
Are there some that could be making a living from it?
Yes.
I know how desperately many congregations are in terms of an organist. You can't find them.
Mm-hmm.
The women are working. And those who can probably are working too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the other problem with organists is that there aren't as many people who know how to play the organ. I don't think it's just that women are working. But why not? They're choosing to do other things rather than but the decision to learn to play the organ comes pretty early in your life.
It could be that the organ is an arcane instrument.
Oh. Yeah. She just started piano lessons.
And
I think
all
that
though has to do with whether or not your parents appreciate art and are making it available to you. So is this happening? Right. Are we depreciating in our raising of families and so forth, the arts?
Well, you know, I guess always that I see that there's more than one force that's operating. There is the sort of mediation or that become the media superstars in art, which I think has hurt some people at the middle range. But also there is the informal art that exists because people have more leisure time. They may not be learning the organ, but at least they're playing the piano, or the tremendous growth in people playing recorders. I think in our own parish, you know, if we lost an organist, that would be a problem because it would be a mental transition. But frankly, there are lots of other musicians, And if we could learn to be satisfied with recorders or flutes or pianos, we wouldn't have any trouble with music in our congregation.
Is the same thing true in the workplace, in a sense?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing we find in both places.
Right.
But how realistic is it to tell your children that they should seek a job that they really enjoy doing in this day and age? Has that changed so drastically that that's not really, that they get real satisfaction out of, that we really don't have we're handicapping them by telling them this?
I don't know.
I find it's a real frustration. You've been given a talent, use it. Find an area where you really enjoy work, because if you can enjoy your work, then you're really experience satisfaction too. And I
was told too that you can expect to change your occupation three times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, from when you
at least. Start.
Yeah, me too.
But with this kind of thing where you just do a job, you don't find any satisfaction in it, you know, and you find your satisfaction elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
You're living your whole life as a grease monkey, which you actually hate like mad.
Yes.
And go home and you derive your satisfaction from a paycheck, maybe, or from the life in the church where you feel mm-hmm. worth or that you're able to provide for your family.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only alternative, or is it still possible to tell people that?
I think, at least in my experience, because we hire lots of people where I work and we worship in a college chapel community, it seems to me that people are making two prior decisions. They're not listening to their parents anyway.
Yeah.
One, they're deciding where they want to live. I would like to live in the Pacific Northwest, or I want to live in the Bay Area, or I want to live in New England. That's one of the things that people are deciding is. And the second thing that I think is even as powerful, if not more powerful, they're deciding what kind of community I'm going to work in. Am I going to be able to collaborate, whatever my skill is, whatever my expertise is, am I going to be part of a team of people, and am I going to be respected as one of the decision makers? I want to have a say about how work is done.
But not everybody can do that, you're saying. Aren't you
No, it's true.
It's just impersonal and there's no...
Yes. But at the same time, we also have the lands in phenomenon, where they've learned that if they're going to have people who are polite and nice on the telephone, you don't get that by saying, this is exactly what you must do when someone calls. Don't ever ask about their hometown. Get that order as fast as possible. We want to have high calls per hour. It's a paradox, I guess, if you will. They want you to say, we want you to be productive and we want you to be pleasant. And the only way that I find that happens is when you say to people, okay, our goal is that you be productive and pleasant. Now, Irene, how do you think that's going to happen? And so you sit in a room with 20 people, and 20 people get a say in how work gets done at Land's End. That's what happens at Land's End.